good to see you again this evening. It's been a wonderful day, a beautiful day. Any day that you have reasonable health and accomplish something is a beautiful day, isn't it? Whether it rains or not. But we've had some rain. We've had some sunshine. Weatherman says we're going to have some more rain. So it's working out all right. As soon as I find time, which will be at least a couple of more weeks yet, I will put together some of the pictures that I took, along with some that are being sent to me by email from Great Britain, and show you some of the things that I saw on my trip over there. I saw one thing that was very interesting that unfortunately I didn't have the camera with me that day. You know, a man's camera, when he's away from home, ought to be like his teeth with him at all times. On the way back from a visit to a Scottish royal castle that was used as a hunting lodge, name of which doesn't come to my mind right now, we passed the farm where Dolly the sheep was cloned. And I said to John, can we stop here a little bit? And he said, well, it'll have to be a little bit because if we stay too long, we'll be late to church. So we stopped a little while. And fortunately, I saw the farmer that helped clone Dolly and took care of her as long as she lived, which wasn't long. And I said to him, how come you're not cloning any more sheep? Well, he said, scientists don't believe it's worth the effort. And I said, really? Why not? Well, he said, in the first place, Dolly was an inferior sheep. In the second place, though she came from a sheep that had splendid wool, her wool was not splendid. He said, we would grade it good. In the third place, he said, from the day she came into existence until she died, she was sick. And nobody could afford to have sheep like that. The vet bills would run hundreds of thousands of pounds every year. And he said, to make a long story short, she wasn't worth the effort. I said, how many times did they try before they got Dolly? You see, they're talking about making cloning people now. Only in this country are we that foolish. But he said, I don't remember. But it was thousands of times that they tried before they finally got the cells to go together and make Dolly. I said, you think you'll ever clone a human being? And he said, not a Scotchman, they won't. He said, no, I don't think we ever will. I said, why not? He said, we're not smart enough. There's a big difference between a man and a sheep. Well, seems to me like I read that in an old, decrepit book somewhere. Did I read something about that? Okay. I said, you don't think they'll ever try? Oh, he said, you know how people are. They'll try anything. I won't say they'll never try, but I will say they're not likely to succeed. He said, we have not been able to clone higher animals. And so we talked about cloning a while. And he says, we're not smart enough to do that. Well, then where did we come from? If we're not smart enough to do it, how did a frog get smart enough to turn into a land-dwelling animal? You see the ramifications of all this? Got home, picked up a magazine, started reading about a robot that has been invented over in France, and he is touted to be able to do everything a man can do. So Brother Kyle Butts from Montgomery, Alabama, went over and visited him, this robot, and he wrote an article telling what it can do. He can go around a room without being held by the hand, but he can't go out of the room because he doesn't know how to turn a doorknob. Aha! Now we know what you women think of men. He's got a hand that functions, quote, something like a human hand, more than a claw, but not a hand. And we're not sure we can ever build one that will function like a human hand. Furthermore, he can't see and he can't hear. But the scientists who spent hundreds of millions of dollars making him said one good thing about him: he doesn't eat. Well, of course he doesn't. He's a machine. He's run by a computer. But this one scientist, Brother Butt, said to the one scientist, one of the ones who actually helped make him, he said, compare him to a man. Tell me about him. He said, oh, I don't want to go into all that. He said, he's vastly inferior to a human being, and right now he's the best we know how to make. Well, where did we come from? We came into this world seeing and hearing and hungry, didn't we? And so you see all of the stuff that we hear in this country about they're going to build robot soldiers who will fight for us in the future. They've been playing too many video games, I tell you. They've been playing too many video games. And so none of that's going to happen. Another place I got to visit was Rosamond Chapel. Rosamond Chapel is the seat of Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. And I got to see that grave of that Knight Templar. The crypt of the church building, we call it the basement, where they bury people, is supposed to be full of Knights Templar. And so when the guide took us down, he said, now here is our Knights Templar. And somebody in the group spoke up and said, that's all you got? We thought there was a whole bunch there. And he said, oh, you've read Dan Brown's book, haven't you? Yes, we have. Well, he said, don't put much stock. He said, it's done one good thing. It's increased our visitors from 10,400 a year to 145,000 a year. He said, we like that because we're making money hand over fist. But there is not a word of truth in Dan Brown's book about this chapel. So he said, there are no secrets here. There's no old charts here. And the figurines that you see on the posts and the walls and places like that, though they have been here since the 15th century, they don't represent anything except the art of that period of time. And I couldn't help but think of the fellow when we went through Edinburgh Castle a few years ago. Someone asked him, have you seen the movie Braveheart? And he said, yes. He said, how much of that was true? And he said, well, there was a Scotsman by the name of William Wallace, and there was another one by the name of Robert the Bruce. And when you've said that, you've told all the truth that's in that film. Be careful of Hollywood. They don't tell you the truth about anything, particularly not things of this nature. But we'll talk more about that perhaps in the future. Tonight, we want to get to the last chapter of the book of Habakkuk. And I discovered in looking through material and so forth today that we have only three more books to cover, and we will have covered all 12 of the minor prophets in this study. And those are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And so, God willing, next week we're going to begin with Haggai, the great temple prophet. And we're going to talk about what he urged upon the people of Israel. You know, President Reagan told Gorbachev, Mr. Gorbachev, tear this wall down. Haggai told the Jews, Jews, build this temple up. And so we'll begin to study that next week. But this week, we're going to look at the final chapter of the great prophecy of Habakkuk. Why, can't you see it on the window?
Not very well. Thanks, Rick. I'll tell you, when you've edited as many manuscripts as I have this week, it's a wonder. Don't ask me my name. I don't know who I am.
All right. When Habakkuk wrote his book that, of course, bears his name, around 612 B.C., probably just prior to or just after the fall of Nineveh at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, he concluded with a long prayer that's recorded in chapter 3 in the form of what the Jews called a Shigneoth, or a Shigyaoth. Strong defines this Hebrew term,
as a type of rambling poem. In other words, it doesn't conform to the rules of Jewish poetry. It was written rather loosely, rather than composed by strict rules of Jewish poetry, such as those by which the Psalms, for example, were composed. But this type of poem not only talks about various things, but it reveals the conflicts in the emotions of the author who spoke or wrote it. The way that Habakkuk wrote is not nearly so important, however, as what he wrote. And so we're going to look at it almost verse by verse this evening by noting that he began telling God of his attitude and his request, writing in the second verse of this chapter, "O Lord, I've heard your speech." You know, Habakkuk asked God some questions, didn't he? God answered them, didn't he? Habakkuk said, "I've heard that. I know what you said," and was afraid. "You frightened me when you answered me." Then he prays, "O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy." Now you'll recall that among the things that God told this prophet was that he was going to send the nation of Babylon to punish the nation of Judah because of Judah's sin. Habakkuk, knowing that Babylon was even more sinful than Judah, asked God how he could send a sinful nation, one as sinful as Babylon, to punish his own people. And God didn't answer that question directly, but he did tell him that he was going to do it. And when he answered him, it made Habakkuk afraid. And so he prayed to God to revive his work. His work referring to the nation of Judah. Revive the nation of Judah in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. And then he pleads, "In wrath, when the punishment comes upon us, remember to be merciful to us." He told God, "I heard your reply. The answer caused me to fear." And he asked God to revive his work in Judah, that is, preserve this nation for the future. And God did that. Habakkuk then extolled God's awesome power by reciting in highly figurative and poetic language things that God had done with various nations, including Israel, in the past. And so in verses 3 through 16, he began almost with the beginning of Israelite history at the foot of Mount Sinai. And there he talked about what God had done to Israel's enemies and what he had done for Israel. He said God came from Teman. Teman, of course, is another name for Arabia. The Mount Sinai was in Arabia. The Holy One from Mount Paran. Mount Paran was down in the land of Edom. God conquered the land of Edom and caused his people to pass through it on their way to the promised land. His glory covered the heavens and the earth was full of his praise. It's a figurative way of saying that when God brought his people out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the land of promise, he glorified them by forming them into a nation. God had demonstrated his power, not once, but repeatedly, in the journey from Egypt to what we would later call Israel. The people feared even the voice of God. You'll remember in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 19, they spoke to Moses and said, you go up and talk to him. If he speaks again, we're going to die. I don't know what they thought would happen to Moses if God spoke to him. But they said, you go talk to him. They observed the demonstration of God's power at the Red Sea. And the prophet asked him to revive the demonstration of that power. Show us that you'll be able to take care of Judah. He wanted God to renew the demonstrations of his power as quickly as he could before the nation was punished. But God had decided not to do that. Habakkuk likened God's appearance at Sinai to a great thunderstorm. The prophet wrote in verse 4, his brightness was like the light. He had rays flashing from his hand.
Can't you just see God throwing the lightning bolts? He had rays flashing from his hands. And there his power was hidden. He didn't use all of his power even then. They saw this terrible storm on the top of the mountain. And they said, God's in that storm, Moses. And if we hear him speak again, we're going to die. You go up into the storm and talk to him. You go into the lightning. You go into the thunder. You go into the darkness. We're afraid of him. Unfortunately, they didn't remember their fear. His power was demonstrated in the 10th plague in Egypt. When, as Habakkuk puts it in this chapter, before him went pestilence and fever followed at his feet. Remember the Egyptians all got sick? And the firstborn of every family died, including the Pharaoh's son. That's what Habakkuk's talking about here. Judah had forgotten this. They had forgotten all of those plagues and the power of God. God had demonstrated his power in the conquest of Canaan in verses 6 and 7. Here Habakkuk talks about the fact that Joshua's conquest of Jericho was an amazing thing. He said, he stood and measured the land. Our translations say earth, but the Hebrew word is land. He looked and startled the nations. And the everlasting mountains were scattered. Now, he's not talking about physical mountains, but the great nations among the Canaanites in the land of Israel. The perpetual hills, the nations that had been there for years and years and years and years, bowed down to God. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan, he said, in affliction. He saw the people scared to death of God, and the curtains of the land of Midian, tremble. He saw God do all of that. Furthermore, Habakkuk likened the fall of the Canaanite nations in the days of Joshua to mountains being scattered and hills bowing in respect to God. A figurative way of speaking of nations in the Old Testament as well as in the New was to call them mountains. Or hills. The tents of Cushan, the curtains of Midian, refer to just two of the nations that fell during the entry of the Israelites into the promised land. In verses 8 and 9, the prophet asked God an interesting question. I told you he was called the questioning prophet, didn't I? He asked God an interesting question. He said, "Oh Lord, were you displeased with the rivers? Your anger against the rivers, was your wrath against the sea that you rode on your horses, your chariots of salvation? Your bow was made quite ready. Oaths were sworn over your arrows. You divided the earth with the river." Now, none of this is literal. It is all highly figurative. And it's talking about things that happened in the history of Israel. God did not divide the Red Sea and stop the flow of the Jordan River at flood tide when the priests waded into it with the Ark of the Covenant because he was angry with the sea and angry with the river. God wouldn't be angry with things like that. He made them. He did not destroy the Egyptians in the Red Sea because he was angry. He did it for the purpose of preserving his people. He did all these things, including fighting on behalf of Israel in battle because of his love for his people and his desire to preserve them in the land of Canaan. The problem was Judah had forgotten. Again, he likened the nations to mountains, saying in verses 10 and 11, "The mountains saw you and trembled." Well, mountains don't see, my friends. The mountains saw you. The great and high governments of the land saw you, and they trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. They knew their fall was going to be like being caught in a flood. The deep uttered its voice. The sea uttered its voice and lifted up its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of your arrows they went, at the shining of your glittering spear. The nations of Cana saw God's might, and they trembled because they were troubled by it. You know, an instance of this is found in the second chapter of the book of Joshua, verses 9 and 10.
There was a woman by the name of Rahab. She's called in the Bible a harlot, and that's caused people in modern times no end of trouble because they don't understand how God could use a harlot to accomplish his will, even allow her to come into the very lineage of Jesus Christ. But they forget two things. God talked about what she was in the past, not what she was when she was saved by the Israelites. Not only so, but the same Hebrew word means an innkeeper. So maybe she wasn't a prostitute by our standards at all. Maybe she ran a boarding house. And so I don't think we ought to worry about things like that. God uses the right people at the right time to get the right job done. He always has. He always will. And we should never, never forget that. But at any rate, Rahab, you'll remember, hid the spies on her roof under flax. And here's what she said to them. I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted. They tremble. What did Habakkuk say? They're faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. Sometimes we get the idea in the Bible that nobody around this 1.5 million Jews who were making their way out of Egypt into the Promised Land knew what was going on. Can you imagine an invasion by an alien force? I mean, somebody out of Canada or Mexico or Europe or somewhere else, coming into this country and causing, first of all, one of the major cities to fall down without ever firing a shot. Can you imagine how we'd talk about that in this country? Well, that would be like giving your parrot to the town gossip, wouldn't it, Randy? Why, it would go through, the news would go through this nation more quickly than anything you can realize. What God did, he did not do in secret. The Egyptians knew what he did. They even wrote about it in later history. The people of Canaan knew what he did. As a matter of fact, at a place called Tel El Amarna in Egypt, in 1896, a German archaeologist was digging around. That's what archaeologists do. They dig. And he came across a cache or a stack of terracotta letters. Now, they would often make big plates, we would call them, you know, out of terracotta, and they'd write a message on it, and then they'd dry that, and then they'd send the message to whoever they wanted to have it. And out of this tell, they found at least one letter from every major king in Canaan saying that they were being invaded by Hebrews, and would the Pharaoh please send an army to help defend them? And there was a letter from every major city in Canaan except one. There was no letter from the king of Jericho. You know why? That's how they knew they were being invaded. Jericho had already fallen. And so Rahab says, we've heard what God did. We've heard how he divided the Red Sea. We've heard, you know, about the battle that you had with Sihon and Og and how you utterly destroyed their armies and killed those kings. We know that you're coming here to take this land over. We know that we're going to fall. The only thing I want to ask you is, will you please preserve my family? And the spies said, you hang a scarlet cord out the window, and when we come, you'll not be harmed. And so you see, Canaanites knew they were coming. They were scared to death. And I don't blame them. I would have been too had I been in their place. Also, in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 13, the sun stood still for him so he could get a battle fought before dark.
Some days I wish it would stand still too, but it doesn't for me. So the sun stood still, the book of Joshua says, and the moon stopped. Well, isn't that what Habakkuk just said? Till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? And we have no idea what the book of Jasher is, but whatever it is, if we ever find it, we're going to find a historical record of this event. So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And that's what Habakkuk said happened. I don't know about you, but if I were being invaded by people who could pray and the sun would stand still, I would be scared out of my wits. God conquered the whole sea of Canaanites. Sea is often used in the Old Testament to refer to nations. Habakkuk chapter 3, verses 12 through 15. You marched through the land in indignation. You trampled the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people. There's the reason. For the salvation of your with your anointed. You struck the head from the house of the wicked, and by laying bare from the foundation of the neck. You thrust through with his own arrows the head of his villages. They came out like a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was like feasting on the poor in secret. You walk through the sea with your horses through the heap of the great waters. God went through that land like Grant took Richmond, didn't he? I can say that in West Virginia, but I wouldn't say it over in Virginia. He just, like Sherman went through the South, that's the way God destroyed the people of the land of Canaan. When God reminded the prophet of this history, the prophet responded in these words. He said, "When I heard, my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones." You know, I was like a man whose bones wouldn't hold his body up. "And I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up to the people, he will invade them with his troops." And the "he" that's referred to in this passage of Scripture is the Babylonian army. His reaction was both physical and emotional. It frightened him because God was saying, "I'm going to do again, only this time to Judah, what I did to the Canaanite nations when I gave you this land." And Habakkuk said, "Lord, that scares me." And well, it should have. The prophet then came unglued, as we would say today, when he realized that God would do the same to the nation of Judah that he had done to the Canaanites. The Babylonians would utterly destroy them as a nation. And it would be a terrible thing to see his own nation destroyed as Canaan had been from the conquering armies of Israel. You see, the Canaanite tribes, nations, never recovered. Not to this day. And neither did Judah. Her people came back and she started again, but we're going to learn when we get to Haggai, it was a weak start and a weaker finish. And so that's what the prophet is telling us. He closed this chapter with a hymn of faith. We would call it a doxology, a short hymn sung to the praise of God that expresses either adoration or faith on the part of the one singing it. It's found in verses 17 through 19. And here's what the prophet said. "Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor the fruit be on the vines." Here, incidentally, he becomes more poetic. "Though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I'll rejoice in the Lord. I may not have anything to eat, but I'll rejoice in the Lord." Because you see, all the things that he mentions here produced food for the Israelite people. "I'll rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like the deer's feet, talking about giving him the ability to run fast from the Babylonians. And incidentally, this Babylonian invasion was only 25 years away. And he will make me walk on my high hills. And so he's saying essentially the same thing that the three children of Israel told Nebuchadnezzar. You remember Nebuchadnezzar said, if you don't worship me, I'm going to throw you in the furnace. And they said, well, go ahead and throw us in the furnace, your majesty, because we're not going to worship your idol. And if you throw us in the furnace, our God will preserve us. Now listen to the rest of what they said. But if he doesn't, we're still not going to worship your idol. And so Habakkuk is saying, God will take care of me. He'll look after me. But if he doesn't, I'll still rejoice in him. I'll find my salvation in him. The Lord God will give me strength. He'll preserve my life. And I'll walk on the hills when this is all over. Habakkuk closed with this doxology in which he made several, I think, important points. No matter what happened, war, famine, or want, he would rejoice in God and find his joy in his relationship with the Almighty. Oh, that we would do the same in the modern church. God was the source of his strength and would bring deliverance and preserve him to walk on the hills of Judah. This expression of faith is unequaled in such a time. No other prophet made a statement like this, and few of us would today. Habakkuk said essentially the same thing as Job said when, remember Job's wife came to him and said, why don't you curse God and die? He said, don't be foolish, woman. In Job 13:15, he said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Even so, I'll defend my ways before him. I'll plead my cause before God. If he kills me, I'll die trusting him. My, oh my, what faith. No matter what happened to both of these great men, they were going to maintain their trust in Yahweh, in God, in Jehovah. What a lesson for us today as we face the problems of life. Sometimes when you're ill with a chronic illness, oftentimes when you see your old friends one by one taking their places in the silent halls of death, you feel like, oh, maybe I ought to just give up. But you can't. That's when your faith has to grow stronger. And you have to say, no matter what comes, I'll trust the Lord. Take the advice of the great proverbist who said, trust the Lord with all your might and lean not to your own understanding. We need a relationship with God that allows us to know that we, as children of His, can escape certain condemnation awaiting those who know not God and obey not the gospel, to borrow a phrase from the Apostle Paul. We need to have a serene faith, a trust in God that lets us know that no matter what happens in life, in this time world, it'll be right for us. I read a story just this morning sent to me by a friend whose wife was undergoing a routine colonoscopy, and the physician, finely trained though he was, perforated her large intestine. She had to be rushed into surgery. They had to cut her open. They had to take out part of the bowel and do a resection. And he said the physician came into her room later, and when she was awake and alert, and said, I want to apologize to you for all the pain and suffering that I've put you through. I did not mean to harm you or to hurt you in any way. And then the fellow said the tears began to roll out of his eyes. And he said, you'll never know how sorry I am. Feeble as she was, she reached up and took his hand, patted it and said, "Don't worry, doctor. Everything will be all right." And it will. Everything will be all right. There used to be a faith healer up in Pittsburgh by the name of Catherine Goolman. Do you remember her, Betty? She had quite a reputation, didn't she? But she'd come on the air by saying, "Good evening. And have you been waiting for me?" Oh, I just knew you would. You know why she spoke like that? She stuttered. Can you imagine what it'd be like to have a faith healer come on the air and say, good evening. Don't work. But then she would add this, and this part of her message was true. So long as God is on his throne, and I'm not going to say it like she did, but so long as God is on his throne, everything will be all right. Friends, the last time I looked in my Bible, he's still there. He's still on the throne. And you and I don't have to look forward to such a terrible end. We can look forward to something much, much better. In other words, we need to be Bible Christians so that we can take advantage of the love that God had for us to the point that he sent his only begotten Son for our salvation. I know what it's like to have an only son. I'd think a long time if you asked me to kill him for you, even in a very humane way. And I love you. Jesus came to the earth on the agony of the cross. He cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Well, God forsook him so we can be saved. He cried that out because God wants us to be saved from sin and to live forever with both the Father and the Son. Do you have that salvation, my friend? Are you a Christian? Are you a believer in Jesus Christ in the New Testament sense? Will you come, if you don't, to receive it tonight?